I'll recount it as best I can. That was what, like, I was in the advertising department. I usually got there about 8 o'clock, and we had a little cafeteria. And on Friday, I would go down, and my cohort who handles food and drug advertising with me, Don Campbell, he and I usually would meet for coffee. And on Fridays, usually Jack Ruby would come in to place his weekend advertising, and he would join us for coffee. And that Friday morning, he did, on November the 22nd, about 8 o'clock or so. When I got there, he was in the cafeteria with Don Campbell. They were having coffee. I sat down with him, and Jack was his usual self. He liked to talk about his strippers and how tough he was, and he flashed his brass knuckles that he had in his suit coat and bragged about toughness. But he usually came in, and he placed his weekend advertising on Friday with our department for his strip joint there, along with another nightclub he owned. And he always paid in cash, and he kept the money rolled up in his pocket. And he always bragged about the money he had and about the gun he carried under the front seat of his car. But that was a normal morning. And then I left the coffee shop, I guess, and came on in to my office, and left my office about 9 o'clock to go out and make my advertising calls. I came back into the office probably sometime after 11 o'clock, and Jack Ruby was still sitting at John Noonan's desk, who sat directly behind me. John handled the downtown advertising where his club was. About 11:30 or so, I got Charlie Mulkey, one of my advertising friends, and we went down to our personnel office to redraw some parking spaces they were doing that day, and then walked 3.5 blocks over to try to get a good spot on the corner of Main and Houston to watch the parade as it come by and turn there. We couldn't get that spot on the corner of Main and Elm. It was already too crowded, so we moved down about halfway down Houston Street from corner of Main, between Main and Elm, in front of the county jail there, and they were just unloading a no parking sign set in a big concrete bowl there. So I got up on that concrete so I could see over the crowd and had a good view. In just about a few minutes, about 12:15, 12:20 by then, across the street on Houston, on the sidewalk in front of this reflecting pool that's there, a man had an epileptic fit. And I remember him writhing around on the ground, and just almost out of nowhere, here come this ambulance, turned the corner off, loaded the man in there, and then took off down Houston Street over the Houston Street viaduct towards Methodist Hospital, we supposed. And the thing I remember so much about it now then was that of all the documentaries that we've seen on JFK that I have and the shows, there's only been one that depicted that thing that happened, and I was really impressed by that particular show and that. But in any case, right after that happened, within two or three minutes, the parade came. Passed by in front, and I remember Jackie and waving and seeing the president. And as they turned the corner on Elm Street in front of us, which was a half a block down, and started down that Elm Street in front of the book depository, we heard all these noises. And I couldn't tell you to this day, I couldn't then, whether it was one shot, 10 or 5 or whatever. It was just an echoing noise. To me, it was no definite gunshots, and I did not recall any 3 shots. It was echoing. So in any case, I crossed Houston Street between some parade cars over to that reflecting pool, and I could see people running down toward the grassy knoll and the railroad tracks. So I started down the esplanade, which part of it runs parallel to the book depository down towards that fence. And down when I got nearly to the fence, a policeman in brown, we called them county mounties in Dallas, at that time stopped me, and he had a shotgun. And Charlie was behind me, and he said, "Where do you guys think you're going?" We said, "We're going back to where all these people are running," which was back towards the fence in this parking lot or that area on the top grassy knoll. He told us to get the hell out of there. So Charlie, I guess, left me at that point. I don't know where he went, but I went ahead and started down that esplanade, made a left, started down towards beside the picket fence corner there, and at the top of those steps that go down the grassy knoll. And it was there that I saw people laying all over in the median grass between there, a couple of motorcycles up on the, laying on the side of the hill, people and police running up towards the picket fence to the right of me. I looked down at the top of those steps before you take this top step was a huge puddle that I thought was blood. So I walked on down around it down the steps and I saw people in the median between Main and Elm laying on the grass, people crying. I looked back and I could still see people headed all around the grassy knoll in that area. And no one was going towards that book depository at that time. No one. There was no one headed that direction. So I rushed on back to the news to see if I could find out something. And as I come in the door, by then it must have been 12:45, maybe a little bit later than that. Jack Ruby was still at Noonan's desk. And I said to someone that Connolly might have been shot, and maybe even the president. I remember Jack Ruby jumped up then and ran back to our corner office. Dick Jeffries at that time was our promotion director. He ran into his secretary's desk there. He could look out the window directly down at that assassination site. And I remember him on the phone crying and talking. Well, about that time, I saw Jim Hood, who was our ad department photographer. And I went up to him, and I said, "Jim, I think I've seen some blood or something down there where all this stuff took place." And he said, "Well, let me get my camera. We'll go back down there." So he got his camera, and we went rushed back down there. It was probably one or a little after by then. And everyone was gathered up around the book depository then. We came up to this this blood area, which now was all crinkly, like it coagulated a little. And he put his little pinky on his right hand into that, and he stuck his tongue to it, and he said, "Well, that's blood." And he made a photo with his reflex camera. And we came on back to the news. And, of course, we heard then that the president had been shot and all this. So it was Sunday, I guess, when I was home then, watching television as they were getting ready to transfer Oswald from the city jail to the county jail. And when Jack Ruby stepped forward with that hat on he had and that dark suit, I recognized it instantly as he shot him. Well, I come into the office Monday morning, and Hugh Ainsworth, who was a news reporter, was there talking to Don. And Don turned around and said, "Coley there was at breakfast with me. And me and Jack, and we all sat there and talked that morning." And I said, "Let's go back over, Jim, this morning and look at that blood." We went back over, and there was no stain to be found anywhere. It was like someone had cleaned it off very thoroughly. And then I got busy in all my daily work that I had. Nothing else happened till Tuesday a.m. the next morning when I came in, and someone told me that Hugh Ainsworth in our Bulldog edition, which is printed about, back then, about 9 o'clock. They were printed for newsstand sales and downtown honor box sales. There was a story written by Hugh that said Coley at the news and had visited with Jack Ruby that morning. Someone then showed me that edition. I looked at it, and I said, wow. It wasn't 30 minutes later, while I was preparing to go out, my wife called, and she was hysterical on the phone, and she said, "I've just received two threatening phone calls. They both have said, if you don't shut your mouth, they're going to kill me and our two kids, a boy and a girl ahead at that time." And I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "That's what they said." I said, "It's some quack. I don't know anything. I haven't said anything." So I made my morning run, and I got back probably about 10:30 that morning. At that time, as I sat down to begin working on my ads, two men came up in dark suits. They kind of flashed a green ID card and said, "We're the FBI. Are you Coley at the News?" That was mentioned in a story this morning. And I said, "Well, I'm Jerry Coley." He said, "Did you have coffee with Jack Ruby Friday morning?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "We want to talk to you in private." So I said, "Wait just a minute." So I went to the back of the room to our vice president's office, and I said, "Si, I'm scared. Would you verify who these people are?" So Si Wagner came up. He said, "You sit down in my office, and I'll go up and talk to them." He went up and talked with these two men, and he came back in a few minutes and said, "Jerry, they're okay. Go ahead and talk to them." So they said, "Where can we meet in private?" And I said, "Well, we got a conference room just up here in the front of the room." So they said, "Let's go in there and talk." So I went in, and one of them, the taller guy, was doing all the questions. The other one was making, looked like shorthand notes. I couldn't tell what he was doing there for sure. And he asked me to talk about that morning with Jack Ruby. And I did, and about when I was down at the parade area, and then I said, "I want to ask you a question." And the guy taking notes said, "Well, wait a minute. We're not here to answer questions. We're here to ask in a rough kind of way." And I said, "Well, it's about some blood I saw there." Well, right away, the man interviewing said, "Tell me about this blood." So I told him what I'd seen, and that one of our advertising photographers had made a picture of it. And he said, "Is he here now?" And I said, "Yes, he sits just outside the door here." He said, "Go get him. Get his camera, his negative, and any positives that he's got. And you come back in here." So I went up to Jim's desk, and I said, "Jim, can you please come in here with me and bring your camera and your negative? Did you print that piece out?" He said, "I just printed out that photo this morning." He said, "You know, I don't have right way in that photographic lab. The newsroom has first priority, and with all that's been going on, I haven't been able to print that picture." He said, "But I just did this morning." And I said, "Well, get it and come in here." So he brought the camera, the negative, and the positive was in a brown envelope. The FBI man, we went in, and he introduced himself, and they had us sit down. The FBI, who was doing the question, man, took the negative, and then he took the envelope and opened it up and looked at the print, and that was the first time I had seen the print. It was just a print of the blood stain there on the blood there on top of the steps. And he wanted to know if there were any more prints made, and Jim said, "No, I've just been able to make that one this morning." So then they turned and had some sort of muffled conversation between themselves, and seemed like after an eternity as they stood there, probably 2 or 3 minutes, but the big guy stood up, and then the other one did too, and he put everything in the bag, put them under his arm, and he said, "Boys, this conversation never took place, if you know what we mean." And they walked out the door and left. Jim and I sat in that conference room, and he said, "What the hell is going on here? What have you got me into?" And I said, "Jim, I don't know what's going on. I just know that my wife's been threatened." He said, "What?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, what are you saying?" I said, "I'm not talking to anybody, Jim. This," he said, "then you shut your mouth, and I'm going to shut mine. And let's don't talk about this blood mess anymore." And I said, "I won't." Well, we didn't. It wasn't long after that, a few days after that, I received a subpoena to Jack Ruby's trial. And on the subpoena, which I still have, it's addressed to Coley at the News, which I guess was taken from that news story that ran in a two-star edition only. I don't know when it was, in the 70s, sometime after that, Unsolved Mysteries, an NBC production, called and said, we would like to meet with you after work and listen to your story about Jack Ruby that morning and your association with him. And I said, fine. So they came that afternoon about 6. About 9 o'clock, they took a short break, and I called my wife to tell her what was still going on, and I said, you know what? Everybody that could corroborate my story about the blood now is dead. Jim Hood, Cy Wagner, Don Campbell. I said, you know, we've never talked about it. I just got to tell somebody and get it off. Let it be open. And she panicked. She said, don't do that. And I said, well, you know, if I talk about this, they'll think, well, at the worst, I'm some kind of nut. Nobody's going to believe me, but at least I've told it. Well, I did, and they nearly flipped out. They said, we want to come back the next morning, and we want to go over to where this happened. We want to, and they did. I met them, and we went over there. This thing went on all morning long, and finally they said, okay, it's a wrap. We'll call you when we get back to California and give you the run show date, the show date for that we're going to run this. Well, they called us, seemed like 2 or 3 days later, and says, we can't use that blood story. We couldn't substantiate it. And I said, I told you that when I told you the story. That's why I told it to you. So they said, well, we can only use the other part about Jack Ruby. Then after that, I've been interviewed by the Japanese out of Tokyo to Japan. They came over and talked. And of course, they had all kind of wild theories. I don't advance a theory in what I've seen other than I know that what I saw, it scared me to death. I know my wife was threatened 3 times on the phone for me to shut up, which I hadn't said anything other than that story that Hugh had written about me talking with Jack Ruby that morning. And I know that when this happened, I was there. I saw the people run towards that picket fence. No one ran towards the book depository. And that's all I know firsthand, sir. On the steps, there is an esplanade-looking thing. It comes down the hill
right, to
Elm Street, and there's steps. It starts almost close to that corner of the picket fence there, just to the right of it. These steps come down to the sidewalk. Well, you know, my personal theory is it had to have something to do. Someone was hit there. Right. It's up that grassy knoll that leads down to the Elm Street kind of. Right. Elm Street kind of makes a semi-S coming down around that curve. And it's, yes, sir, like Jim and I still remember Jim saying, my God, if we can't be truthful to the FBI, what's going on? How big is it? What's happening? And he said, I don't know you, but I'm shutting my mouth, and I think you better, too, since you're one getting all the threatening calls. And we both said, we're not going to talk about it. And we didn't for about 13 years before I talked about it. It was after Don and, as I said, the 3 people involved who could corroborate my story that morning died that I said, I'm going to talk about it. Hugh Ainsworth, he's one that I don't quite understand either, because someone told me that Hugh Ainsworth at a speaking somewhere or something, or maybe he's written it, I don't know, said, oh yeah, I saw that up there. It was a soda pop. And I thought, wow, I had a man that and a photographer who tasted that. It was blood. But anyway, so, you know, he can say what he wants. It doesn't matter. He wrote the story about me talking to Ruby that got me in all this trouble. The photographer was Jim Hood, H-O-O-D, And the man that worked with me in my food and drug was Don Campbell, C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L. You know, Jack Ruby, and all the stories I read and the things that I heard even before he died was that he was such a patriot and how he loved the president. And I really found that hard to believe at that time, that if he really loved the president, why would he just be hanging around our office when he could walk 3.5 blocks down the street and see him in person come by, he and his wife? That just never, it just never made sense to me. But yes, he was. So as far as I know, he was there from 8 till about, I guess it was 9 that morning I left. I know he was there then. He was there at 9 when I left to go on my advertising calls. When I came back around 11 o'clock or so, he was still there sitting at John Newnham's desk. He usually came in on Friday, but he normally was never there more than about an hour. There when I came back from the assassination site, yes, he went to there's a TV over in that corner. And he was sitting at that desk. He had called someone. The news was coming out at that time that the president had been shot. And I remember him crying on the phone. And Jim Hood and I then left the second floor office to go back over there. So I really believe that. I believe by then he probably had heard the news that the president had been shot. I don't know at that time they were saying he was dead, but I believe he was upset. Tears. I don't know if it was shock or not. There that day, yes, that day. I saw him. Then on next time I saw him was on television as he was shooting Oswald. It came out Tuesday morning, because Monday morning was when Hugh was talking to Don, and Don said, well, hey, Jerry was there with me. Coley was there with me.
Yeah.
So in this story, Hugh said Coley at the news was having coffee with Ruby. That's yes, they're very hard. In fact, we have tried several times since then to find and could not. They only save a certain amount of few papers back then.
Right.
That's
have a copy.
True. Yes, sir. Oh, okay, that's all right. Yeah, no, sir. All I'm saying is this is what I know, not hearsay or hand-me-down or happenstance. This is what I know. And what happened to me and my family. And, you know, of course, we've all got ideas about things, but this is what happened. That's right.
Right.
Well, we really thought so, because the first caller, the first one that called her said, is your husband Coley at the news? So there had to be some correlation to the story. And then again, my subpoena reads Coley at the news. Jim Hood, who made my picture of the blood, left the news not too awfully long after that, went back to Oklahoma, and I usually saw him once a year. He would call me and say, he was a big Oklahoma fan, and said, I'd like tickets if you can get them for the Texas-Oklahoma game. And I said, sure, and I usually get him 2 tickets every year. Well, after a couple of 3 years, he didn't call. And we began to wonder about him, and so finally we tracked down his wife and found that he had died strangely in a plane crash. He was a pilot in a little small plane. Had died strangely one day. The plane crashed without any kind of provocation, no bad weather. They just didn't understand, but it crashed.
Death.
Yes, sir. Hearing all those things made us live in fear for about 10 years. We were really terrified. We were really scared, my wife and my 2 children. We just kind of shut up and didn't talk out of fear to anybody. They didn't know what was taking place. You know, the Japanese, when they came, they were really nice, and they, goodness gracious, it's the pictures they made, not with movies, but still shots. And it was interesting to hear their view. They said that Jack Ruby they said, here is our what we're pursuing. That Jack Ruby was that little two-bit hood who was used to shut Oswald up as Oswald was about to talk. They used Ruby to do that, and that this thing was so high in the government and so unbelievable that they said that we'll never hear what really, really, who was behind all this. And I said, you mean like high authorities in our government? Oh, yes, yes. And then they also pointed out to me, which at that time I hadn't thought much about, that when Oswald left his apartment there on the corner of, it was Beckley and Zang, just off the corner there, and started up the street, why in the world he turned down Patton Street and he was headed over toward Beckley and Ewing, I guess, going back east on Patton. If he would have gone to the end of Patton there, turned right on Marsalis and gone up a block and a half, he would have been at Ruby's apartment. And they said, doesn't that seem strange to you? And I said, well, in a way, probably. They said, had he continued on his way, and said, he went home and changed jackets or shirts, I don't remember now. But he changed some clothes, put on a jacket or took off a jacket, and said, how would the policeman sitting there on a patrol, why would he stop him walking down the street 30 minutes after the 45 minutes, I guess, after the assassination on this little quiet street in Oak Cliff? There's so much. I agree. You know, I think this thing is in my lifetime, I'll never know. I was real hesitant for a long time to talk about this because I had, you know, so many people saying, oh, there's one of those conspiracy talkers and he's always looking, he's looking for some limelight. I never wanted any kind, I've not written any books. I don't want to write any books. I've never, even when I talk to these various churches and organizations here in East Texas now, I refuse any kind of compensation. I don't want that. I said my only interest was one day the truth will be known. Yes, that's like the Warren Commission. That was a quick whitewash of everything, and they certainly didn't talk to a lot of people they should have talked to, and it was just a quick way to get the country, I guess, back on track and whitewash this whole thing, get it over with. Well, I appreciate the chance talking with you, and thank you much.